All right, Marty Lurie here with Brian Sabian and Giants Baseball. And Brian, you know, I've talked to Peter McGowan and finding out getting the club and Frank Jordan, chief of police and the mayor and everything that went on. But I've never gotten your story as to how you got involved with the Giants, because you're a major part of all the success of what happened. How did they come to you?
Well, a little bit, I guess, long-winded or convoluted, as you'd say. When I was with the Yankees as the scouting director, which I was 86 through the 90 draft, in and around, I guess it was post-draft, Bob Quinn reached out because this would have been in 89, excuse me, and him and Lou Piniella were about to take over Cincinnati. And they actually asked permission for me to go over there. And ironically, I had just signed an extension. So, of course, the kibosh was put on that ability to free myself up. Not that I was really looking, but looking back, it would have been a good experience to reunite with Lou. As well as, if you remember, they went wire to wire in 90, won a World Championship. And then Bob, fortuitously, was in position to become the GM with the Giants at the end of the 92 season. And as a result, I had a little bit more footing to be able to look to the outside, only because Mr. Steinbrenner was actually banned from baseball. So he was behind the scenes, and he had no day-to-day involvement. And it was monitored very thoroughly and in a real hard and fast way by the commissioner's office. So to make a real long story short, after a lot of pushing and shoving, I was given the ability to interview, which I did in San Francisco. And then I guess the fun starts. Now, obviously, we can't revisit this with Peter, but I think Larry would have a pretty good recollection. And they could be more factual from their side, but all of a sudden, for me to be able to go to San Francisco, they wanted compensation. And from my recollection, it was going to be in the form. The ask was in minor league player form and or money. Now, as it turned out, because of that and because of Peter finalizing the deal to actually take the team over, there was a moratorium on whether I could go there or not, and we went off to the winter meetings, me as a Yankee, and Bob had become the GM before the winter meetings in Louisville, and the rest became history. I was lucky enough after the winter meetings to get in a position to take the job with San Francisco, which was, I look back, I think my thinking was not that my time was served with the Yankees, which was a tremendous experience. I'm sure we'll get into that. But and I had been given some assurances that I was going to be the next man up, and I was the number two behind Gene Michael. But I kind of looked at the San Francisco situation and Bob handpicking me to want to come to assist him as almost like an expansion opportunity. And I thought there might be more creative license or ability to do some different things that we didn't get a chance to do in New York. And again, I had a tremendous experience there and, you know, don't regret any day of my professional life as it's unfolded, but especially with the Yankees.
So you're an East Coast guy, though. Now here at San Francisco with cable cars and hills and Candlestick Park, what was the lure of San Francisco for you? What did you know about it?
Well, where I got lucky because of being scouting director, and it hasn't changed all that much, you're on the road constantly. So, for instance, I would find a way to either get on a reasonable flight actually from New York to get to a night game on the West Coast. This is pre-draft on a Thursday or Friday, and then fly back on a red-eye on Sunday night. And, of course, back then, as you were hitting the early part of the schedule, being that you were going to be in Florida, California, and Texas because of the weather, I had a chance to also spend enough time in the Bay Area seeing the Cals and the Stanfords. to get a feel that, ironically, San Francisco was very much like an East Coast city. And that was a big attraction. And I think, again, looking back, maybe my best recollection of the excitement, not only for myself but my family at that time, was that it was going to be a challenge, but, I mean, California. San Francisco, famed an international city. So it wasn't that big a leap of faith. And now I can't say I would have had the same vision or opinion if Bob hadn't have been there. But yeah. Bob was kind of the safety blanket.
So you walk into Candlestick Park. What did you think about that? Because now you got to start molding a team for that ballpark.
Well, as you remember, we were god-awful in 92. And I shouldn't say that, but there was the regime change of which, Roger Craig was replaced. Thus, here comes Dusty, and that was heaven sent, as it turned out. And then the roster, starting with Bonds, was, kind of in a state of flux, even though we had some core. If you look back at, the Williams and the Clarks, Manwaring, Lewis, Royce Clayton, and some pitching, Burkett and Swift. There were some makings, and ironically, just what the organization needed, more so the fan base, on the way to eventually getting a stadium, was a season like 93. Yeah. So that was really heaven sent, that opportunity to kind of make something out of that roster. And then, we're probably the biggest reason the wild card came into being when you win 103 games and you don't go to the playoffs.
Yeah. It's funny as you look back on your tenure. So you're the assistant to Bob. And you're now at Candlestick, and you're getting a feel for the team. When do you get the job to take over? What happens with Bob?
Good question, because I did have a lot on my plate. Actually, in media guide fashion or job description fashion, when I first came, Tony Siegel was in actuality the assistant GM, but I was a de facto GM. I only phrase it that way is that I spent a lot of time on the road because I was running player development and scouting, including the draft. But, of course, was in touch constantly with Bob, spent most of my time when I could in spring training and around the Major League Club. To make a long story short, the beginning of the 94 season, excuse me, the 95 season, right around spring training, Bob and Peter came to me individually for different reasons and told me that I was going to get an opportunity to be the head guy. And it was going to happen after the 95 season. And it would be at the end of the 95 season. Now, as things went forward during that season, I was also given the opportunity, really with Bob's blessing, and he was tremendous to work for, one of my biggest, promoters or allies, that pretty much from the second half of that season on, and it was really All-Star break on, that Ned Clitty and I, who was in the organization to be, let me back up. Ned had not yet come into the fold, but we were going to be given a chance to really to get ready for the position, or more so give a report card to Peter, make every trip, and be, kind of the de facto GM to be. So really November 1st of 96, after the 96 season, I missed a year there. I think that experience and the fact that I'd been given enough heads up, that the preparation was put in, the nerves were certainly not a factor, and that you were more than ready because you were given the opportunity to kind of do it behind the scenes much earlier than people thought.
Well, you're with Brian Sabian talking about the early years, amazing how all this came together. You're putting your stamp on who you are on the San Francisco organization. What was it?
We got lucky. We had a group, and I'm doing this from memory, so help me fill in the blanks. I don't want to forget anybody. But specifically, going into the 97 season, Ned was the GM. And on the personnel side, we had Dick Tidrow, who was a savior back in the early days and obviously became a player personnel and pitching savant for us over time, was kind of left side and the right side of my brain. I say it that way in that for some reason that group had almost no individual collective ego, and we played off each other's strengths to the point where we covered each other's blind spots. Yeah. So there was a real camaraderie. There was a real passion. We did it 24/7. But none of us individually were the smartest person in the room, nor wanted to be. And as a collective entity, and Bobby shortly thereafter came into onto the scene, and we really had a lot of cohesiveness and. Almost to the point of, true friendship, which is ironic in any walk of life that you could be that hunkered down professionally, but also have, a lot of storylines on the friendship side of things.
Well, the trade happens, the Matt Williams trade happens, and I think this was sort of the watershed mark for you and the fans, because, we know what you're doing behind the scenes and everything else, but you put it out there with the Matt Williams trade. How did it come about, and what do you think of the reaction?
Well, first of all, I don't think anybody was ready for the reaction, but the germination and all that, at the end of the 96 season, we were up against a payroll nightmare in that going into the 97 season, and I don't recall exactly the payroll number, but Matt and Barry as a tandem would have been almost half our payroll. And we had a conversation, and Peter and Larry and I and Ned and Dick pretty much agreed, if you want to kind of take a shortcut out of the second division, you're going to have to figure out a way to trade one of these star players. And as it turned out, for whatever reason, we got more hits and specifically a lot of interest from Cleveland on Matt, to the point where even back then, there was almost never a trade of consequence or being that big between, any clubs in any place and time at the GM meetings. But there had been some groundwork laid, as well as I recall, I think that, during that time frame, a lot of organizations, much like us, to kind of get a head start, would go to the World Series and clubs were available to talk, and then that really helped, early on, especially with the Cleveland discussions early on. Looking back, I think we should have had more vision and been smarter. That Matty was raised as a Giant, went through some trials and tribulations, really, came into his own, probably because of Bond's arrival. And that, in a lot of ways, and I mean this sincerely, not as a joke, I mean, he was the Easter Bunny as far as the fans were concerned. And lo and behold, when we traded him, I think the fallout from that was just, and rightfully so, he deserved that type of outcry of passion a lot more than all of us expected.
Yeah. Well, the trade did come together. Tell us about the inner workings of the trade.
Well, once we knew that they were in a position to kind of take a shotgun approach, and we had an ability to fill a lot of needs in the short term, because if you remember, that season was kind of a rolling addition to the roster week to week or month to month. We saw an opportunity in moving Matt the money to kind of get a payroll reset, as well as put some people in position in a plug-and-play fashion. And as you saw, one of the keys was Jeff Kent, contrary to a lot of popular opinion. He was well-known in the industry on the player personnel side as a guy that was very capable of 20 home runs, 80 RBIs. And we did a lot of diligence on him, not only with our scouts, but people in other organizations. And we knew when giving up Matt's offensive, production, that somebody coming back had to be a younger version of being able to add some thump to the lineup. And then the rest of the pieces just fell in place by virtue of, I think, how interested Cleveland became in the idea of adding Matt to their mix. And as you remember, they were the American League juggernaut. Mm-hmm. So it kind of happened faster. And there was a grind to it, certainly, but it probably happened a lot faster and earlier in the process than we ever could imagine, which to our benefit set up our ability to have the freedom to do other things, including people forget we got $1 million back in that deal. Yeah. That we were able to sign Daryl Hamilton with, and subsequent made separate trades with a lot of different people, including not too far after that, J.T. Snow.
Mm. Well, it's amazing to hear how things worked in those days. A couple of things. One, your personal reaction to the fans. I mean, I can remember everything, he's an idiot, he's crazy, what happened. How did you feel about that? Knowing, look, you have the tremendous baseball background, the Yankees, Steinbrenner, you've been through a lot. And the second part is, in today's world, you can't make a trade like that. You can't get players back like that. Boy, baseball has changed. But your personal reaction to what happened after the trade?
Maybe when I say short term, I mean like in the moment, 24, 48, 72 hours thereafter. The negativity of it all probably did catch me by surprise. I'll tell you a true story, and I spoke to this. I think I did it. A conversation with Andy Bagley. One of the people that really put a better tone on the climate was Bob Rose, who was, as you know, Bob was really gifted as a PR man. And I'm sure that Peter underestimated the reaction. I'm sure Dusty wasn't thrilled with it because you're really losing a cog. And once I understood that this may be a good thing in that people are paying attention. They have the right to be this, upset. And then even though you think you know who you are and your resume, you can't presume that everybody else knows, what your, quote, personnel background is, to have the and as a group, when I speak this way, I'm talking as our baseball group, have the guts and the fortitude to go through with something like this. But you make a heck of a point. It was a different place and time. And it was our way to find relief in so many different areas, starting with the payroll, to again have a short stop on rebuilding, which we didn't want to do, or stay a little bit flatlined. But again, go from a second division team to a team that was going to be very competitive.
Well, you got in the playoffs in 97.
Which was a grind. I think one of the things that happened through Dusty's help, and we really had a good coach and staff, is that group in spring training, there was an identity about it. They were very professional, yet loose. There were some characters. There was obviously some alpha males, and there were some guys that really needed to either resurrect their career or take it to another level. And I think that spring training set the tone for the kind of start we had. We had a pretty good start. Yeah. We started on the road and then came home. And I think looking back as the season unfolded, and ironically later in the year being the trade deadline, we had the huge trade with the White Sox, that the team kept winding its sails because they saw that the ownership and the front office were in sync with really thinking this was an opportunity, A, not only get to the playoffs, but beat the Dodgers in doing so. So my point earlier, with each week, each month, it seemed like we were adding somebody that really brought something to the table.
You know, it's funny going through this with Brian Sabian. The Yankee background, and just growing up with George Steinbrenner and everything that went on in New York, and listening to how you approach this, you had a lot of nerve. You had a lot of confidence, and you move players. The White Sox trade was amazing. Estes, didn't he come from Seattle? I think he came from Seattle. The Yankee years gave you a certain confidence. I get that feeling.
Well, I got lucky as I matriculated and I first started as a college coach, became a scouting director. The rest, from the media guide. But what the Yankee years taught me, being around, and I call it my undergraduate and graduate schooling in the game, being around so many strong-willed and in their own right, famous people and personalities, that you had in this sport, because it mirrors life so much in that you're playing almost every day, and there are going to be good days and there are going to be bad days, there are going to be ups and going to be downs like life, that you better have a sense of humor, but you also have to be ready for, you know, when the crap's starting to fly.
Yeah.
And it was also a different time, Marty. You know, that was, if you remember me now at 62, and I look back, I was in my 30s.
Wow.
That was a look. You looked at somebody, you listened, you thought, and then you spoke, depending on the subject or who was in the room. And I just remember, almost by osmosis, the people I was around and the conversations. In long-winded way to answer your question, in that I think almost just being in that crucible, that it was a proving grounds of sorts, but it also prepared you for circumstances that obviously not only life but especially baseball are going to they're going to be in the picture as you go from season to season. So I think the New York experience, I say this in a good baseball way, hardened me. It hardened me for the rocky ride.
Yeah. You know, it's funny listening to you, and of course you're in your 30s when you come to San Francisco. And I don't know if we realized that then. You always seem to be older. You know, you always seem to be more mature, that, you know, you were a tough guy from the East Coast. And but really, it's interesting you say that, coming from the 30s. It's like you're Theo Epstein. You know, you were a star as a young man, and I think maybe that gets lost a little bit, that the Giants were lucky to get you as a young man with that future ahead of you.
Well, the irony, take myself out of the equation, I'm flattered you make that comment, but you had mentioned earlier, you know, at the time that I was matriculating, and I'm going to digress for a minute, but for instance, at the GM meetings, in one room there would be a table of each organization. So in the meetings, the old GM meetings, when I first started to go with the Yankees, was the GM, the manager, the farm director, and the scouting director. So everybody in that room knew everybody in baseball. And there was a camaraderie, or there was a higher level of interaction and through that respect. But I only mention this in that when I was coming up, even before I became a GM, and with all due respect to some of the people that are really, you know, getting their due or their accolades, you got to understand that our icons and geniuses were Pat Gillick and Sandy Alderson. And look back on how early and young Dave Dombrowski started. So it's funny, back in that place and time, including when I took over with San Francisco, and Billy took over with Oakland, who was an understudy with Sandy, we were young.
Yes.
We were much younger than I think people gave us credit for.
Yes.
And it was I guess, the beginning of, you know, kind of a glacial turning of the tide, that, you know, the old school way of doing business, where a lot of GMs were in the job 20, 30 years and quite often with the same team, or it was very clicky that, you know, organizations or the people therein that were making decisions were a little bit more open-minded to youth and what else you could bring to the table other than being a seasoned baseball man.
Yeah, well, look at Al Rosen for the Giants, perfect example.
Exactly, and you know, people forget that Al was with the Yankees in the front office when they won the World Series. Went to Houston, really got that franchise rolling, and came from Houston to San Francisco. I'm glad you brought his name up, because not only Al, but Mr. Lurie. I can remember when I took over as the GM, and it was just how things played out, I ran into each one of them separately, and they were you know, very happy because they had followed my career, and I think more so Al because I was a Yankee previously, that I'll never forget separately, but almost while it was in their own verbiage, said the same thing. Do what you think's best to create the culture you think that's going to work best. Yeah. And they both pounded that kind of theme. And I also ran into it when I took the job, and I had a one-on-one with Harmon Burns, who was a very charming and highly intelligent man. And that was one of his, I guess, ask or check mark on the checklist for the ownership group. So again, I look back into my formative years, and I that's probably the best schooling you could get. You know as a lawyer, you can have all the book smarts and the sheepskin on the wall, but you got to practice. You know, the practice therein is going to make you better in real time, because the more that we've done jobs like we've had, or as you go, you know, through your career, there's a lot to be said to be ready for crisis management, because not every day goes smoothly, and you got to be agile, and you got to have the right people around you to make the thing tick.
Boy, we'll stop here, but it's interesting. I want to get into the Candlestick Park years of how you dealt with Candlestick. But in listening to you, you've had your generation. And now, again, the baton gets passed like it got passed to you. And it's an interesting part of baseball. And I go back to, you know, Frank Lane and, you know, Buzzy Bavese and, you know, those names, Park Carroll and all the names that I grew up with. It's the way baseball works. It is the way things happen over the years. But the foundation you give the Giants, this is the foundation that led to the championships and led to all the success. So it's good to hear all this in the beginning, because it gets very interesting after about 97.
Well, I'll just add as we close, if you also look back where I've been lucky, not only in San Francisco, but, you know, in the 22 years that I was kind of in the big chair of sorts, as Ned Coletti would say, look at the managers. Yeah. Dusty, Felipe, now to be a Hall of Famer, Boach. And, you know, that's pretty, you know, sacred ground to think that that baton could pass like that. And I was fortunate enough to work with those type of people. And I think one of the reasons that we had success or continued success as things morphed from one year to the next is that we always had a cohesiveness from the top down.
Yeah.
Ownership was in sync with the front office. The front office in sync with the manager and the coaches. And you know from being in a clubhouse, when the players see that, there's no out. When they see that type of cohesion or commitment from everybody else above them, there can't be any us versus them. There's a lot of scenarios where that clubhouse becomes us, and anybody outside that clubhouse becomes them. So.
Yeah. No, we're going to pick this up, but it gets interesting after 97, doesn't it?
Very much so.
Yeah. All right, Marty Lurie here, Brian Sabin, back with more right after this.